Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Pickle Me This, the officially unofficial podcast for Rick and Morty on Cartoon Network's Adult Swim. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Today we're covering Season 5, Episode 3, A Rick Convenient Mort. Here's Aaron with the recap.
While out on a mission to create some custom merch, Rick and Morty encounter Planetina, a sentient amalgam of Earth's elements summoned by an ethnically diverse group of teenagers called the Teenateers to fight pollution and environmental harm. Morty takes all of 5 seconds to fall deeply in love. Morty's infatuation with the potentially 5-billion-year-old Planetina is a problem for Beth, which leads her and Morty to being at odds and Morty running away from home. Meanwhile, Morty's Twitter patient with Tina causes Rick to be left without a wingman on his ambitious sexual tour of three dying worlds. All three are just moments away from suffering a planetary cataclysm that will wipe out all life in their systems, and they are responding by throwing a hedonistic ragers against the dying of their light. Rick drafts a newly heartbroken Summer to join him on his bacchanal, but will their troubled grandpa-granddaughter relationship survive the experience? Will Morty save the planet or at least notch a positive relational experience with Planetina? All right, Jim, we've both seen Season 5, Episode 3, A Rick Convenient Mort.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what did you think of this episode?
I was an unironic fan of Captain Planet back in the day,
back in the 90s.
So, you know, if they're going to riff on Captain Planet in a fun and violent way, I'm down for it. And I thought this was pretty fun. If you know, it's not as good as last episode. I really enjoyed the decoy episode, but this was enjoyable. I don't know how, it's not like super important, right, to Rick and Morty's development. I don't know, maybe the teenagers rebelling against their parents a little more is being amped up, you know, Rick stoking those flames. But
think it's kind of important, maybe from a Morty perspective, and it's like the development of his relationship with his parents and whatnot like that. But right. You know, like, shit, what is and is not important on the show?
Yeah. It's not the evil Morty continuity that people are looking for, certainly.
I think you could, like, there's some people trying to draw, like, you know, the Punnett squares of which evil things and which traumas are adding up to being a Rick and Morty. Yeah, there's people doing
Morty
that
or Morty evil.
Yeah, people doing the evil Morty math on that stuff.
Sure.
But yeah, I don't know. Like, it's I think this episode would have been even funnier had the Funnier Die or College Humor version of Captain Planet starring Don Cheadle had not existed.
Oh, yeah.
Because the concept of, like, Captain Planet just having a fucking enough of this bullshit and snapping and turning everyone into trees or whatever.
Yep.
That's been tread ground, surprisingly enough. Maybe not surprisingly, given the internet and the way it works. But I thought it was pretty good. It wasn't as funny as I was expecting, but it had a lot more heart. It's one of those ones that just has kind of like an ultra depressing ending.
Where it's hilarious that you said it has more heart because there was less heart in this. I remember there were actually 5 kids in Captain Planet, and one of them was Hart, who is conspicuously absent right now.
Yeah, they LeVar Burton just absolutely refused to reprise his role. Wasn't he Hart?
I don't know.
I can't remember which kid was the Hart because I wasn't allowed to watch it.
Oh, what? It's Magic Rings? Seriously?
It had to be, right? Well, you think they're technology based?
Come on.
And who is this Captain Planet saving the world when we know that the real savior of Paradise Earth is going to be Yahweh? But yeah, I liked it. I thought, like I said, I was expecting things to be a little bit funnier, but sometimes Rick and Morty like to go with the heart or some poignancy. And I thought it's a lot of good stuff. If you are suffering the end of a relationship, or if you are a teenager or can relate to being a teenager and not being understood by your family or really any of your friends or anyone at school, I think this stuff probably resonated pretty well.
There was one really funny scene. One of the funniest things I've seen this season is Rick and Summer eating ass in the ship. Yeah. Just, you know, talking about what they'll be like. That was pretty good.
I really like some of the verbal puns of Morty walking in to the rest of the Tina Tears trying to sell Planetina to an individual Arab person who's not really representing any group. Walking in and saying, "I got a cheesy Italian extra crispy for you."
Yeah.
Referring to the fire guy he just lit up. That was pretty fun. And a lot of fun voice cameos. Allison Brie as Planetina, who I think they've got damn near all of the Community cast to do voiceovers, except for maybe Donald Glover. Definitely Donald Glover's not been on the show.
Huh.
I think this might complete the set. But you had Steve Buscemi as the cheesy Italian.
Fire.
That got extra crispied. Brandon Johnson, frequent contributor to Harmontown and voice actor on the show.
Hmm.
And then this was the first episode directed by longtime friend of Dan Harmon, Rob Schraub, who joined the writing room last year. Rob Schraub is a nut, is a fucking certified nut. He once filmed a parody of Jaws 4 starring his penis as the Jaws. And a giant orange as Michael Caine. And that orange got fucked by the end of that movie.
Hmm.
You can Google it. You can Google it if you want.
No, thanks.
but that man wrote a script with a lot of heart. He's also the voice of the Diesel. What is his name? The Diesel.
Diesel Weasel.
Rat.
Yeah.
Diesel Weasel. That's right. Wrong rodent. It's not a rat. He's a weasel. So I'm interested to see more of his, cause he's a little bit more of a Roiland, in terms of like zany antics. But he also can do maybe he is the fully integrated blend of Dan and Justin, who knows?
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. the thrills of King's Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
All right. Do you want to do Morty and Planetina, or do you want to do Rick and Sum Sum, the Summerfest?
I'll start with Rick and Summer. That's a little less impactful.
Okay. Well, at the breakfast table, where we a lot of times get the episodes going, it seems like Summer is beside herself because Morty is making time with a planet thing, and she just got dumped right before a big pool party, and she's just major league depressed. But Rick has got a plan for her, a ridiculous plan involving three planets that are about to suffer a cataclysm. It's like a sun exploding, a black hole, and a deep impact comet scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And all three planets in this neighborhood are going to celebrate the end of their civilization with one last no sexual holds barred, morality consequence free, complete blowout of a party. That's what they're going to do. They're going to go from planet to planet and just engage in meaningless sex. There's only three rules: no whining, no crying, and no getting attached. A bonus goal: eating as much ass as you can. What do you want to talk about far as this goes?
These parties, end of the world parties. This is what I hoped that the end of the world party in Independence Day would have been. But it was quite a bit tamer than this. People like dressed up weird. That was basically the extent of the Independence Day party. And I don't know. I feel like anything you can see at any nerd con at this point is probably not end of the world material. Mm-hmm. But I guess maybe back in 1996 it was. I don't know. These like end of the world parties are much more what I picture when I think, oh, cataclysmic event that can't be stopped. We're all dead tomorrow. We know the day and time. Just fucking go for it.
Yeah. Have you ever seen the movie Seeking a Friend for the End of the World?
I have not.
Because
no.
That there's no like there's the parties are confined to kind of like the staff at TGIF no longer charging for mudslides.
Right.
And getting super drunk and doing a bunch of drugs because
come on,
there's
have
no
a fucking imagination.
Yeah, like it's kind of although it is interesting, like how certain do you have to be that your world is going before you do some of the things that we see in this episode?
Pretty sure. Like, look, California's on fire. I'm not out there fucking anybody in weird ways yet.
Right.
We'll talk when like it creeps over the Rockies, like
much less our fathers. Like, I don't. I feel like that's not something you just even at the end of the world, you just do on a fucking whim. Like,
right.
You know what? Let's try some gay incest. That's what we need to do.
Especially because my dad's old.
Weird.
It'd probably kill him.
Wow. Well, okay.
He's had heart problems. Yeah, that wouldn't go well. But I guess it's
father,
the end of the world. Who
my
cares?
Father's old too, but he's had a quadruple bypass. He's probably good to go.
Nice.
But like, yeah, what the fuck? Like, I've heard there's this podcast, like I've never heard an episode called Come Town, where like this is one of the running jokes, like having gay sex with your dad somehow. So I don't know if this is a Come Town cross contamination or it's just a Rick and like what is the weirdest, profane, taboo touching thing that you could suggest on cable TV. Yeah, weird though. Weird.
Yeah, for sure.
Because yeah, like I'm thinking that's what I'm thinking. Like if there was an asteroid coming to Earth and they say it's going to hit, there's no way that the Earth scientists would ever say there's 100% chance it's going to happen. It'd probably be like we're 93% sure that it's going to hit and it's going to hit in these. And it's going to do this kind of devastation. Blah. Yeah, I don't know. I don't. You have to desire. You have to have the desire to fuck your dad in the first place to act on it, right? It's not
for
just
sure.
Like, fuck, it's in the world. Why not? Let's just, who knows? It's a weird space for the thing to go.
Or to get peed on. Like, oh, I don't know. There's several things back to back there that they're just like, yeah, I want none of that.
Yeah, it's also interesting because sometimes Rick and Morty is kind of like my moral barometer for like, not necessarily for who I am as a moral person, but like the things that I like get squicked out by, you know, yeah. Just I got a little borderline squicked out of just Rick and Summer going on this giant fuck fest. I wondered, is this something that like Rick and Morty have done? I know they've done an off screen adventure where they're going to pound a bunch of mermaid puss, but it's almost like always alluded to. And whenever like Rick is confronted with his grandson's sexuality, he's always kind of like appropriately disgusted by it, which you should be by 14-year-old sex life.
This episode starts with them potentially going on a pussy pounding expedition, right? I mean, that's based on their shirts that they're creating.
I think you're supposed to understand that that Rick was going to take Morty on
And then he got infatuated with Planetina, and that whole thing was off, so he needed somebody else. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a hastily modified t-shirts with, Rick and Summer pussy pounders. Which turned out to be elbow licking. I don't know. Like I said, I'm not.
I didn't find that very funny. Did you find the elbow titties part funny? Because I was indifferent to it.
It's funny just because they pixelated it out, and it's supposed to supposed to use your imagination for how amazing these elbow titties must be, and like what you can do with them that would cause Rick to be so, you know, dependent on the elbow grease.
I don't know, man. It wasn't doing it for me. Sorry.
Also, that voice, Jennifer Coolidge, Stifler's mom.
Really? Okay.
Yep. Guest star.
Nice.
Yeah, I don't know. But that's the thing. It's like, I kind of was like, well, okay, do I believe that Rick's going to break the rules for this woman, that these elbow titties are this good or something, or she's so... But I guess, like, then my next thought is like, well... Rick doesn't really need that good an excuse to break his own rules. Yeah. Like the excuse can just be, I want to do it. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly the rules are for squares and blah, blah, blah. And so it's like, I think maybe the point is this is kind of dumb and Rick just doesn't care. But I don't know. Summer's reaction to elbow titties was maybe that they are a force to be reckoned with.
I guess so. Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I thought that her whole speech about this is what you're up against. These are what wars were fought for. These have ruined kings. They've inspired presidents. I thought that I wanted to kind of take it at face value. I also really love some of the animation, like the sequence of Summer diving into the just writhing fuck street of slugs. And essentially swimming through those muscles and mucus to get to the get to Rick's saucer was pretty inspired. Then her just like pulling out of it and seeing all that thing, does that landscape slide past.
Yeah.
Pretty rewarding for pausing and rewinding. There's a lot of like, again, I love an animator that would spend two or three work days on something that your average person seeing this is going to see for two or three frames, you know?
Yeah, no, they're great about that. The animation on the show is really good.
Yeah, it's a hell of a lot of fun. I also really like the reaction to Summer saving the day. Both Rick's, which is, you know, him admiring the fact that she would be so petty to save a planet, not just because she can just literally push a button and save the day, but particularly to fuck over Rick and his new toxic relationship.
Yeah,
but I also really like the planet's reaction of like, we got to live our lives now. We got to go to work in the morning. Fuck, we got to look our fathers in the eye. Fuck you. Fuck you.
Yeah. Which, you know, is what the stinger does, right? How their moms, the woman of the house is not talking to them because
they're having the gay sex.
Previous
the gay incest.
Which, so I don't know. That's probably an appropriate reaction for some amount of time.
Yeah, I don't know if you get over that one. I don't know how you reconfigure your stuff that is no longer an issue. But I didn't think it was interesting because it seems like it's a deliberate juxtaposition of like society's working on sudden and sure doom. Like there's no talking your way out of the pit. It's happening. It's happening tomorrow. Versus society's struggling with very slow moving, uncertain inconvenience.
And man-made doom. As compared to universal catastrophic events, right? Supernovas and black holes. Those are things we have no control over, whereas Planetina is fighting against the things that we do.
Yeah, yeah. It's just, I think that there is like deliberate, but that's the thing. It's like, I don't know where the commentary, because I was expecting this to say definitively one thing or another about, like, you know, the climate and climate change and planetary destruction, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It said a lot, and I don't know what is the dominant voice here, because, like, should we just give up because we've already passed the point of, you know, because a minority of scientists have said that, like, turn off the lights. It's already too late. You know, we've started runway things that are going to make the shit that we've been dealing with the last 5 or 10 years look like tiddlywinks. And there's really nothing we can do technologically to stop it. There's many more that say, no. We can certainly slow things down and kind of put the retro rockets so that society can kind of soft land into some sort of state equilibrium in 50 years or so. And of course, there's the other very small minority that says, fuck it. There's nothing. There's no problems. Keep doing what we're doing.
Right.
What do you think the show's opinion is, if any?
I think the show's opinion is that we're headed down a very bad road. It's just what are the solutions, right? Because Morty's very much like the pacifist, don't solve it with violence type. Planetina is very much the solve it with violence, because I've seen how this road goes if we don't solve it with violence, because we've been doing it for 50 fucking years now. She's been doing it for maybe 5 billion, who knows,
right?
Which, let's just say, if she's been monitoring the Earth, taking care of its ecosystems for 5 billion years, she's done a shit job so far. So
she needed to write 4 teenagers to put her together, man. All she was is just a disembodied spirit before.
Right. You probably could have got in there the first time somebody rolled coal and maybe put the kibosh on that, let's say, or maybe the first time somebody
First time the cavemen started rubbing two sticks together.
Get in there and blast them.
Yep. Keep that internal keep all forms of combustion under wraps and you got it.
Just eat fish and vegetables, raw veggies.
But I thought that was if we're going to shift over into the next plot, the Rick and or the Morty and Planetina plot. You know, Morty's point there about, like, well, this is what it takes to save the planet. I don't want to. Like, if it takes mass murder, and there's some people that advocate for this, like eco-fascism or eco-terrorism, that, like, we need to just wipe off like 90% of the planet's population, if not all of us. And we need to have these rigid blah, blah, blah. And we need this, that, and the other. Like, if that's what it takes to save humanity, maybe, you know, or also maybe this is just a referendum on us as a species. Because, like, again, to not put too fine a point on it, this planet's going to be fine. Like, nothing we do to it is going to be so bad, except for maybe all out nuclear war, that other life won't thrive on it eventually. So what we're really talking about is the human experience on Earth coming to an end or becoming very hard or hostile. And then, like, if there's kind of poetic justice to us doing it to ourselves. And, like, that justice is not averted if, like, you know, 0.1% of the planet just decides to take things over and impose this gun. I don't know. I don't want it to be that way, but I also see the logic to us, you know, sleeping in the bed that we've made.
Oh, for sure. I guess the question is, like, how hard do you fight for that? It's like, I think of it as like a body's sort of immune response to a disease. Like, when, you know, parts of the body are rebelling against the body as a whole, the body cuts that shit out. It's merciless in cutting that shit out. And, like, is that what our society needs to become? Right. Like, the immune response of our society is, well, this element of the society is wrong and bad and killing the rest of it, so it's got to go. I don't know. I think there are points all around, because, you know, we also don't want to turn into that ourselves, right? Because that could be a slippery slope. Who determines who the bad guys are, who needs to be, extricated from society, and who does that? All big questions that are hard to answer, and like, I certainly don't want the responsibility of answering those, but also I don't want our civilization to just completely disappear because we decided we'd rather sit on our butts and do nothing while a certain portion of it destroys what we have.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, like, that I think that's the kicker right there, rather. You know, when Morty and Planetine are talking to the coal miners, and the coal miners like, hey, you people didn't have the votes. But that kind of stuff, I think when we started democracy, like, we envisioned, like, okay, if you say that to someone's face when you're talking about whether you get bike lanes in the city or not, fuck, we didn't get the votes, you know, we're not gonna have a subway this year, or we didn't get the funding for the stadium, or, you know, we're gonna have to cut back on the libraries. But when you're talking about, like, hey, you people didn't get to vote, so we're stuffing these other people in the ovens, or you people didn't get to vote, so we're going to let a very, very small, minuscule fraction of people just continue treating the earth like it's their fucking latrine. That's a little bit harder to swallow, especially when it's not like a huge majority. It's not like 90% of people want to do this, 10%. It's when the odds are a lot. It's I don't know.
Well, and it's not the only issue you're voting on, right? Like, if you were to come to them and say, do you want to destroy the planet by doing these things? Everyone would say no. 99% of people would say absolutely not. But when you mix it up with 15 other things that are affecting their daily life right here and right now,
yeah, like, what,
and ask them to vote
use
on that, they will maybe, you know, put off the sort of bigger issues in order to get some, you know, some thing for themselves today. So, like, yeah, we're short-sighted, we're kind of stupid, we're a little bit selfish, but also I think people would not choose, you know, not being able to get the votes for something does not mean people have chosen to do that thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's wild. And there's a couple other things I thought was interesting, because, like, you know, Rick is always the smartest guy in the show, and or supposedly. And when he says stuff like, he throws an aluminum can on the ground, and Morty's like, Jesus Christ, not in front of Planetina. And he's like, it's 7% of the Earth's crust, Morty. Yeah, I'm sure we're going to need every atom. Like, that's not why we recycle aluminum. We recycle aluminum because, like, it's super energy efficient. Like, it costs, like, I don't know, something ridiculous, like 5% of energy to take aluminum and recycle it back into aluminum than it does to, like, take raw aluminum and turn it into something you can create a product with.
Get it out of the ground in the first place, right? We've already invested that money in getting it out of the fucking ground. Well,
yeah, why rip another mountaintop off when you can, with all the environmental damage and spend the insane amount of electricity to get the stuff? Because I guess that's the real draw. It's like, turning aluminum into something usable just requires a shit ton of heat and power. And when you can just melt an aluminum can and for a fraction of that, like, why wouldn't you? And I, like, that's the thing that, like, I don't know, like, if you know, like, obviously Rick and Morty has a pretty diverse crowd of people watching it, and when you put the smart, you give the smartest guy on the show, even though he is a nihilist and he also is not not above doing dumb shit, I do wonder, like, what that does to the viewership. Like, do they think it's, like, you know, a joke to recycle aluminum? Because that's the other thing, is, like,
right,
it is kind of a joke. And this is something, I'm sorry, I've been mentioning this on several podcasts, because it's a true fact I've just discovered, and I'm fucking aghast because hardly anybody knows it. It is a joke. Our plastic recycling worldwide is literally a joke. As far as I can tell, we ask people to separate their plastics. They do kind of a shitty job of it. They don't really clean it to the net. And then the vast majority of those things just get plowed into the ground in landfills because there's no cost effective way to recycle plastic. But, like, glass and aluminum, those are the, like, real, and to extent any kind of scrap metal, that's the real success stories in recycling. And you're shitting on one of the biggest success stories by the smartest character in the room. I don't know. Maybe an entertainment party foul. A bit.
Yeah. Like, are the people watching this thinking, oh, well, you know, Rick has an endless supply of seemingly free energy. He can create just entire species of beings to power his car. So maybe he could do that for whatever recycling or extraction or whatever. He could go out into space and get aluminum from the asteroids. Like, are you factoring all that in? Or are you just hearing, oh, aluminum recycling is a stupid thing to do?
Exactly.
Because the vast majority of people, you're right, are probably hearing the latter.
Right, right. And that, I don't know, like, to the extent that, like, that's the thing. It's like, so what's that going to do? Like, maybe there's a couple hundred people around North America who are going to start throwing their aluminum cans away and stop because Rick says it's stupid and there's 7% in the Earth's crust and all that stuff. I don't know, but it's 100 people that we probably don't need contributing to the problem. But it's so weird because, like, there are a lot of times when they have Rick do something kind of like counter to, I guess, you know, the accepted conventional wisdom, they'll like have a little wordplay showing to how, you know, like he uses the R word and Morty's like, oh, you can't really do that. And Rick essentially gives a little sermon on like the true issue of the thing and how this wasn't what. You know, it's like there wasn't even that, like, you know, Morty, there wasn't any back and forth to make Rick be clever. It's just that he shits on recycling. But it's Rick and Morty. It's a cartoon. What are you going to do?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the whole episode is cynical as hell about this. Right. I mean, look at the Planetina stuff with the kids and their marketing. Yeah. Doing cons with Planetina and marketing Funko Pops of Planetina and.
Which are destined to be in landfills. I mean, is
plastic. Like, vinyl is plastic. So, like,
sure,
yeah.
Sure. And, like, all these exclusive that are selling. I mean, they're, like, taking shots at con culture there. You know, you can buy this exclusive thing for $50. It's going to be in a landfill. The fact that Morty is really only into the environment because he wants to get in Planetina's pants.
Which is a pretty tried and true trope in cinema, yeah.
Sure.
I mean, Always Sunny does an episode about this.
Oh, and then the fact that, like, he's not even helping.
No.
You know, in the grand scheme of things, scooping up one rabbit is not going to do anything, especially when you've got Planetina. And I think there's also a little bit of that. The fact that, like, that's another one of the tricks they use is to make us feel like, as individuals, we're responsible for all this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's, you know, part of the marketing of, like, the Captain Planet and here in the Planetina stuff is you are the solution. Bullshit. Bullshit, we're not. I couldn't pollute enough in my entire lifetime to add up to one day worth of big industry pollution. It's just not going to happen. So,
yeah,
I'm not the problem.
Yeah, especially since, again, like recycling, when we're talking about like plastics and a lot of paper products, we've been doing kind of the quote unquote right thing for years and years, and it's not doing any good because it's by design. Like the whole plastic recycling, like so many other things, turns out to be like a big business plot to make people think they're doing something when they're not really. So they won't affect their behavior because their behavior is making people rich. So, and that's the big thing about the environment is like, if you factored in all the externalities, all the trillions and trillions of dollars we're going to have to spend mitigating this, if we'd have started 30 years ago factoring that in to our decisions, then we could have made a lot of positive progress without, you know, by a comparative song. But now we're going to be paying these bills. I don't know, it's one of those things where they're taking pot shots at people doing just cosmetic, you know, environmentalism, like look at this one person that cleaned up a beach and threw away the trash and it looks good for one day and we should all do that. But you're right, like as long as there's 8 billion people and the system set up to reward the short-sighted behavior, all the individual actions in the world are not going to overcome that systemic problem. But again, this episode wasn't really about that. We've talked, you know, spent 30 minutes talking about this thing and you know, maybe there was 45 seconds of stuff in the actual episode dealing with it. But
yeah, I mean, it's all like circling around that topic. And I think the episode has those things in mind when it's creating, when it's being created. But I don't think it, you know, sets out to address any of those specifically.
Yeah. They also they're also an interesting question about whether Morty acted virtuously by setting Planetina free, because on the subsequent watches, I noticed that there's this throwaway line where he's texting Planetina at night and he's like, oh, you looked really cute on the news. And she's like, oh, the Tina tears don't let me watch the news. It's too upsetting. It's entirely possible that the Tina tears kept Planetina from destroying the Earth in her wrath for the last 30 years. Like they're the ones that have to always talk her out of like going and, you know, sinking the oil fleets and raising, the oil fields of Texas off the ground. And they're like, as teenagers, they're barely keeping a lid on her. And they, as adults, they're just like, you know what? We're just going to forbid her from watching TV. We're going to keep her so busy on other stuff that she can do. Because what else? If you unleash her, she's going to wipe out all human life. Because of course she's going to.
Well, yeah. Is she going to wipe out human life, or is she going to destroy the systems that are keeping them well fed, let's say? Like, it didn't look like the kids were hurting for much, were wanting for much. They had this big fancy tour bus. They were the ones, like, they just call her in. She doesn't need to eat. She doesn't need a house. She doesn't need anything like that. They are the ones who are benefiting from this status quo, not her. Right. So, like, keeping her complacent seems to be some analog to, you know, what business is doing to the people in our society.
There's this interesting, I can't remember if it's a short story or a comic, but they postulated, you know, like Superman, like the world scientists come to Superman. They're like, look, we've done the math and we've created this massive generator that has a crank that only you can spin because you're Superman. And mm-hmm. if you just crank this thing all day, all night, it will generate enough power to essentially solve all the world's problems. There won't be, like, we can use electrolysis to separate seawater from fresh water. We can power all of our cities. There will be no war for, and Superman, like, weighs it. And he's like, okay. So instead of saving people individually, saving the people going off cliffs in their cars and doing all that kind of diverting, he just spins his crank, and that's his job, as to generate free energy for the planet. But yeah. It's asking a maximum sacrifice for one person. Like, this one person who can do anything, most powerful of us, is reduced to just turning a crank. Mm-hmm. And what that is like for him as Superman.
Is this a comic saves, book like, plot, or did you come up with this?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. It's part of the plot. It's think about what it's like to be Superman. And also, like, once the world, what is Superman like? He ushers in his golden age of this new technology and stuff. So eventually the world doesn't even need him to turn to crank. So then Superman is like literally superfluous. He's ruling over this peaceful world. It seems like if Planetina wants to solve the Earth's fucking energy problems, maybe she needs to stop torching miners alive, and maybe she needs to start turning that fucking crank.
What would that look like?
Yeah, like, I don't know. Some kind of at the North Pole, some kind of massive generator that she turns and powers all of, but like, she's got superpowers, and best thing you can think of is, like, torch people again. Also at the wrong end, she's going after the, I guess she did set one senator's house on fire, but even then, that's the lackey. Yeah. The senator's not running the fact, like, you know, go attack the root of the problem.
It's pretty tangled in corruption. When you talk about government and business, I think those are all valid targets in her mind, certainly. But I get you. It's like, those miners are just trying to survive. I get that. It's not like you need to go there and torch them. You could have removed them from the equation by, I don't know, scooping them up and flying them away and then come torch the mining facility.
Yeah, you could make sure everyone's out, collapse tunnels, destroy all the equipment. Essentially, you do everything that Greenpeace does, except for you're invulnerable and you can't be arrested.
Right.
Because you just demanifest or do whatever you want. Yeah. The other thing is, at the end of this episode, Tina's still out in the world.
Uh-huh.
So I'm wondering if we're going to, like, there'll be, like, just things on the TV, like, that have her increasingly, you know, ramping up her war on the forces of pollution, and, like, Rick's gonna have to do something about it at the end, or will she get some kind of stable equilibrium, or will we just forget that we ever had a Planeteer or a Planetina?
I'm sure they'll make reference to it eventually. They like to do that.
I did like the touch of her, like, big flower arrangement that looks like Morty's head. Like, it's slowly getting more and more haggard and horrified throughout the episode, till it's like just like looks like a rotted face screaming while he's crying himself, consoling himself in his mother's arms.
And then there's something hilarious to me about the, like, disproportionately epic nature of this relationship with his teenage life, with a normal teenage life. Right. Like, he's texting her and he's like, I got the flowers you sent me. Thanks. No one's ever sent me flowers before. And it's this fucking arrangement that, like, you'd see on one of those a competitive flower arranging competition shows or whatever. It's like the most gaudy, ridiculous thing you can imagine is the first time he gets flowers. And he's in this relationship that doesn't end with like normal teenage stuff, right? Like, oh, they said something to somebody that, you know, I misunderstood or didn't like, or they didn't go to my birthday party. They went and hung out with their friends instead. Mm-hmm. That type of shit usually ends teenage relationships. Here, it's like, well, you killed a bunch of people and you're now an eco-terrorist, and I don't think I can be with an eco-terrorist, so bye.
Yeah. Yeah, which is actually pretty mature for Morty. I feel like season one Morty would have just become an eco-terrorist along with her.
Yeah, maybe so. But, you know, maybe he'd be naive and just follow along with whatever she wants to do.
And there's other than the tale of two Mortys in this episode, like his mom still sees him as Morty, the kid who has essentially made no character development since season one, episode one, when everyone kind of worried that he was something wrong with him intellectually, developmentally. Versus this Morty, who is self-assured in kind of his way and powerful and has been to hundreds of planets and survived hundreds of scrapes and is capable of biting off of person's firing and wielding it against them expertly. Mm-hmm. You know, like this thing he goes, this like this rant he goes on his mom to his mom that, like, you know, I've never fit in anywhere, not even this family. Every time I open my mouth to say something, people roll their eyes as if the act of listening to me is a chore. I thought that was like a really interesting observation about, you know, what it's like to be a teenager in a family who doesn't quite get you.
This show, 100% these writers still get what it feels like to be a teenager. I remember that angst of like being old enough to feel like you want to have a life, but too young to really have one yet.
Sure.
It's like, yeah, I want to go out there and I want to do all of these things, but shit, I'm 14 and I can't. So
yeah,
like I'm just counting down the days until I can be a real adult and treated like one. And it's funny also looking back at that as almost 40-year-old man now, it's like, oh, I wish I had stayed in that mode a little bit longer because, you know, you get past that and you sort of think, man, those were the days when I had so many fewer responsibilities. And why was I so angsty about it? But when you're a teenager, man, you just want to get out of that fucking mode. You want to become a person. You want to have a life. And I feel for Morty there.
It sucks to be in between. Like, you're too old to be naive and think your parents know everything and life is perfect, but you're also, you know, and it's also like you mentioned your experience as an older person. I'm also have the added benefit of having a real life 14-year-old, like a real life Morty Smith living in my house and like seeing it from the other side of the parents' side, where it's like a decade ago, you're shitting your pants and now you want to go out on a date. Like, it's really easy to get gripped up of like looking in the back and seeing like what an idiot this person was because they didn't know anything and they're so naive and not looking ahead to like Jesus. And like, you know, I'm at the countdown. It's like, man, in another 6 months, this kid's going to be operating a motor vehicle. Mm-hmm. And a year after that, without adult supervision necessarily. And a year and a half after that, the fucking government could draft him into war.
Or he could leave the house and go do his own thing entirely.
And that's like, going to happen no matter what you do. So, what's the balance between trying to, try to keep them safe and informed, but also kind of letting go a little bit to recognize that they are going to have to responsibly manage their affairs. It's a real trick. And I don't, especially when you got some destabilizing force like fucking Rick in the mix.
Yeah.
Sabotaging your efforts to parent and all that kind of stuff. I don't envy Beth Smith. not one little bit.
Rick, speaking of Planetina still being out there, I assume Morty still has the rings, right?
Although he never wore them after the one slaughter scene.
Yeah, maybe he gave them up. Maybe he threw them in a river or something.
Yeah.
After what he did. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I really loved when he blew up, used Air's ring to blow up Dirt's head.
Yep. There was a lot of inventive and the using the dirt or using the fire's ring to melt dirt and burn dirt, water with a lava pool.
He got the last one with like all three of the other rings, which was pretty good
combined. Yeah. I thought that was, that whole sequence was funny. I love the Arab sheik that was his own guy and doesn't want to be used as a symbol to hate other Arabs. And he gets eaten by a tank of baby seals before he can club them, presumably, and make a coat out of them. I thought that stuff was pretty funny. I also really like the Punch My Lunch game. Because it's like an amalgam of like all the stupid family games, Mousetrap,
Don't Wake Daddy,
Don't Wake Daddy, or like whatever the one with the shark was, where it bit a balloon, and like all these things where you roll a dice and you click this thing, and this is just the epitome of those bad idea games where you're punching this guy until he throws up on you. I thought that was, and the fact that the family is playing that as a first date idea with their son and his older girlfriend.
Some of those games got pretty messy. There's a pie one, which like you every time you land on a certain square, you stick your face up to this thing, and there's
I played
pie.
That game.
You do?
Fucking my nieces loved that game back in the day. I forget what it's called, but like, yeah, it had a little catapult system to where you had to take a chance getting pied in the face.
Yeah, but it was pretty messy. You know, it's an actual like cream pie you're gonna get hit in the face with. So I was a little disappointed when he punched his lunch and it's just a bunch of plastic pieces coming out. I wanted something grosser. I wanted maybe some slime. I wanted something a little more visceral.
Yeah, get that Nickelodeon slime. Yeah. Mix it up. That's really looks like he's messing himself. Although I have to say, taking a cream pie from your dad, that's something you do in the last day. Last day of the planet, you know.
True.
Yeah, you want to say some of those games, you want to not play the advanced mode until civilization is going to definitively come to an end the next day.
Oh yeah, you only play the cream pie game with your nieces and nephews, I guess.
Christ,
not your parents.
Okay. Yeah, I guess I walked right into that one, huh?
Kinda, yeah.
What'd you think of the? I looked it up as Kishibashi. I am the Antichrist to you. This is how we ended the episode with Rick and Morty's pretty good at the like emotional bangers. Like they had chaos. Can you feel it when Rick tried to disintegrate his head after his experience with the planetary entity Unity? We have this one. How can Rick and Morty be better at picking pop songs to go underscore emotional beats than like fucking The Walking Dead with literally 10 times the budget?
I mean, yeah, The Walking Dead is they're trying something. It's never worked in the history of them trying it, but they're trying something. Rick and Morty is going for, I feel like, a more tried and true method of pulling the heartstrings. And it works. Yeah. It works.
What is Walking Dead trying, you think?
I don't know. I couldn't tell you, man.
I think it's seeing how little they can walk from the writer's room to the nearest Starbucks and seeing what's on the coffee shop collection. And fuck this guy. Hey, which of our former stars is trying to get a country music career off that we can just get a free, you know, just license some shit for free?
Do we have anybody under contract already? Can we just get them in here and do this?
Who knows? Rob Schraub wrote this episode. I'm looking forward to seeing plus that's the other thing is like I don't. Because like previous DVDs and Blu-rays commentaries have made it the point to where Harmon tends to just make sure everyone's name gets spread around so that everyone gets like, you know, when you say that you are the head writer, that doesn't necessarily mean as much as it might in other shows. It just might mean that like you just like it was your turn to get credit for an episode. Or maybe you had the final draft of it, but like the way their room works, I wonder like if that's still the case, because it seems like they're making a big deal out of the writers this year. Maybe that's just because I don't know, this Loveless guy seems like he's like rocketed it from like writer to executive producer, and Rob Schraub is like, you know, Dan Harmon's best buddy. They broke into Hollywood together, got their start work or writing the animated show Monster House, got on, was it Channel 101, was their YouTube kind of like edgy comedy factory. Came out of the same place in Minnesota, or wait, is it Milwaukee? I can't even fucking remember my damn Dan Harmon lore. But yeah, I'm curious to see what else he can come up with.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Well, then it's time for feedback. We got a couple pieces of feedback this week. If you want to send in some feedback, all you got to do is send an interdimensional cable message to Rick and Morty at baldmove.com and we'll read it. First up, EJ says, is it just me or have you noticed a severe lack of belching emanating from Mr. Rick Sanchez so far this season? I heard once that Justin Roiland has found the constant burping take after take, episode after episode, season after season to be increasingly difficult and annoying. Oh, yeah, Justin? Oh, yeah, repetitive, crazy behavior, increasingly difficult and annoying. Wonder what it's like for the others subjected to you. No. So perhaps there is a conscious effort by the voiceover team to eliminate Rick's trademark, albeit disgusting behavior moving forward, or maybe decoys don't burp.
There's definitely burping in this episode.
Yeah, I had in my notes to talk about this because I noticed that a lot of the decoys, not only weren't burping, but they also lacked Rick's trademark vomit schmear on his chin.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, like, is that a surefire way to detect decoy? Or is that just because I think Rick is trying to do things a little bit healthier? And this episode is, I think, a regression, you know, him going on a full nihilist three planet pussy pounding session. I think it's safe to say it's with your granddaughter is a regression, but I think, I don't know. What do you think? Do you think that they're trying to show a little bit of personal development? And
it could be, yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's what people want to see. I think they want to see characters change and grow, and you can't go much further down than we started with Rick, right?
Yeah.
So you got to get him back on the upswing, to some degree, and maybe he'll fall again. You know, it's not just a straight shot upward.
That's usually characters. How these things work. And that's the thing, yeah. Is like, I've always said, it's like, it's not, you know, like they don't have to necessarily fear like, if Rick gets healthy and learns a lesson, that means he can't be bad anymore. No.
Right.
No, that's not how we work. That's not how us humans work. If all you needed is to get accurate information to make good decisions going forward, like shit, 99% of us would have this shit whipped, but you gotta contend with your limbic system, man.
Yeah.
And here to talk about that is official therapist of the podcast, Tom Jones, therapist from Atlanta, here to talk about some Rick and Morty. This kind of goes to this whole thing. Some brief comments about last episode. I think I really like this episode in the classic Rick and Morty style. You take an idea, draw it out to its most extreme version, and let chaos ensue. I especially love that we got some recurring character cameos and felt that all the sci-fi jokes really landed for me. I especially liked Morty's like Westworld and later like Ex Machina lines, only for Rick both times to say yes, but don't fuck them. Yeah, why is it always, I mean, I know why it always descends into fucking robots, because that's the first thing you do if you develop a humanoid robot. If it was fully functional, you would give it a test fuck. Absolutely.
I mean, look, is it, are machines not there to satisfy our basic needs?
Right.
That's the whole reason we fucking build machines, is because we need to eat. We need to sleep. We want to fuck.
Yeah.
And we need shelter. We build machines to satisfy those needs. Robots are going to get fucked. I'm sorry. It's going to happen.
Yeah, and I mean, it's you can argue about sentience and like what that means, but like, you know, if you're just squeaky about fucking a machine, getting pretty preachy the way you treat your neck massager, Tammy, you know, if you ask for its consent before you flipped on the power button from low to high, I don't think I think you just did it.
Yeah.
But anyway, Tom continues, I keep struggling with this idea on Rick and Morty that I would love to hear your thoughts on. If a character can become clones, have alternate timeline versions, or exist inside holograms, why do we care about personal growth? I love the serialized stuff they do here, but it'll start to feel hollow if I can't trust the versions of the characters I see on screen. For the silly episodes, it doesn't matter, but for the character growth episodes, I'd really like to trust the characters I'm seeing are in fact the characters I'm seeing. Love to hear your thoughts, and the second there are more Dr. Wong scenes, you know I'll be here breaking down my thoughts. This is something we've talked about a decent amount, and I've been thinking since I saw Tom's email earlier, I've been thinking about it more. What do you think?
My initial feeling is that the continuity of these characters is preserved by the show, whether they're the actual characters or not. Like, I don't think the show has ever reset the characters of these characters, you know, if you know what I mean. Like, there is a line you can draw from season one, episode one, to season five, episode three, and you can see growth in whatever version of Rick and Morty we're following right now, right? Because Morty's dead. The original Morty is dead in the backyard. And replaced by some other Morty, and we didn't even skip a beat, right? That Morty was just our Morty now. And I think that's where I come from with this, is as long as the show has a continuity of development for characters that look, sound like Rick and Morty, I'm going to be okay with, you know, whatever number of decoys, clones, robots, whatever, replace them.
I've been... Coincidentally, in the last couple of weeks, I've been reading about like some transhumanist thought on like simulation theory and whatnot. And this seems to me like a trap for just a nihilist trap for super smart people to fall into. But there's this thought that goes along the lines of this, that like if it's technically possible, if you squint, to think that you could simulate an individual's experience. then it's almost mathematically certain that that's happening at some point. Mm-hmm. And once it becomes possible, it's actually much more mathematically plausible that you are a simulation rather than you're in the prime existence.
This is why Elon Musk is accepting Dogecoin, right?
Yep. This is why okay. smart people, they read this shit and they fucking go crazy. Check out Brocco's yeah. Basilisk if you want to see a supreme example of very smart people just shitting their pants. And please, please, if you're a Brocco's Basilisk subscriber, I would want to hear all about it in an email. I really do. So send that in to Rick and Morty at ballmove.com. Encrypted, of course. We don't want the super smart alien robots to get any ideas. But like, there's also this thing called like law of large numbers, where it's like, so if you have a simulation of a person, you know, people are non-deterministic, and there's a big old asterisk on that because actually maybe people are deterministic. But like, I think most people think that people are deterministic, to where like if you took yourself and you simulated you 1,000 times. There'd be a big old bell curve about like what you would do, like what you would choose to have for lunch. You know, it probably there's a big middle area where it's a Chipotle burrito. But then, I don't know, maybe today you went to Qdoba because Chipotle's was closed in your universe or something. All these little butterfly fluctuations make little minor. But if you ran a simulation over and over and over again, you could kind of say that like Jim Jones canonically will do this for lunch. You know, mm-hmm. I think there's this idea that like if you have these simulations and alternate versions of Rick and his family, and as they play out over hundreds of episodes, if you see a certain type of moral arc bending through them, mm-hmm. then you can kind of say with confidence that that is how the real Rick would behave. And I think they're actually, this has been kind of subtext, but they're making it text. Like when Rick had that speech about like, I don't know if this makes any difference to you, but like if Rick made me and I was made by a Rick and I'm capable of, you know, experiencing a small bit of growth. And I mean, somewhere at some point, buried deep inside, the prime Rick can do the same thing. And I think that is the key, the Rosetta Stone for the character development, that like if any version, if like if the parasitic wasp universe Rick is capable of kindness and humanity, then they all are, with sufficiently strong stimulus, they can get there. So like, I think, yeah, it's not our Rick or our Morty, but if one of the Ricks or one of the Mortys can find happiness and love and peace, that potentially that they all could. And you're arguing about whether that's the sweet part of the bell curve, or if it's like an outlier, like Rick finding peace and contentment. Is that an outlier, or is that? And I think that's where it's interesting to see the show explore.
Yeah. And maybe as we see more versions of Rick and Morty, we can become more certain about what the outliers are and what they aren't.
Right.
And sort of define who those characters are for ourselves in some ways.
Right.
But and it also paired with, you know, the concept of the Rickest Rick and the Mortiest Morty. Mm-hmm. You know, that finite curve stuff. I think that makes a lot of sense.
It'd be funny. It also makes sense that the Rickest Rick would be an outlier. Like, would you think that the Rickest Rick would be clustered right in the middle of like the core behavior of the Ricks, or would he be like at one extreme end or the other? And I guess
it depends
how you answer that question tells you whether, you know, and are you interested in the Rickest Rick, the Rick that's so Rick that he's broken and incapable of, like, that could be the Rickest Rick by Rick's own definition. But, you know, the other Ricks might be grateful that they're not the Rickest Rick. You know, like mm-hmm. what prize do you get for being the Rickest Rick? It seems like there's nothing good. It's all just pain and misery. And even when you're happy about something, your happiness is robbed by the knowledge that it ultimately is meaningless in the grand scheme of the infinite cosmos.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't know if that helps. I don't think that even makes any fucking sense, but it's the stuff I've been thinking about the last couple of weeks. Sai writes in and says, in this episode, Rick mentions that the decoys cannot leave the Earth. So I mentioned that there was some people that are undergoing. There was two rules that I think one of the Ricks gave, that like the decoy Ricks can't leave the Earth. And none of these rules. He just said in general, the decoys stay on earthbound, non-continuous adventures, which means that their stuff doesn't have any continuity with the Smith family, which might have wrecked my previous statements. And also, they can't leave Earth. And some people took that as like hardcore rules so that we can eliminate the reason you can trust that the Smith family coming in from the previous at the end of the episode are actually our Rick family is because they're coming in from the deep cosmos, which means they've left the Earth, and they're having a conversation with Clone Beth, which is a part of the overall continuity. So they must be the prime family. The thing is all this shit came from clone Rick or from decoy Rick.
And also, Rick didn't think that the clones would clone themselves or decoy themselves. So
he's already been
completely
wrong. Yeah. Yeah. So like if the fucked up scarecrow Rick was telling you these, would you accept it as fact or just because, you know, it was a non-belching, non-throw up on his lips? But you're like, oh, I look kind of I just don't understand why we think that that's any kind of gospel. But let's say that it is and go along the size point. Do you think that the creator Rick has some kind of agreement with someone powerful on Earth not to leave the planet, or an order from the Council of Ricks not to leave the planet like they do in court cases where they confiscate your passport, or just a foolproof rule set by creator Rick to not get killed by one of the decoys?
I assume it would be the latter.
Yeah. If Rick is under some kind of restriction about leaving the Earth, it's the most violated restriction to like.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe he signed a treaty with Nimbus a long time ago that says that he will forever remain confined to the planet. But like, he's not confined to the planet. So
nope.
I think it's more of like the failsafe. Like, hey, if I'm wrong about the duplicates raiding duplicates, all they can do is fuck up this planet. And we can just move to the corncob planet and we'll be fine.
Were they able to travel interdimensionally?
There's actually a roiling debate right now amongst the Rick and Morty fandom about if any interdimensional travel has happened this season, because all we've seen is like this weird non-Rick portal gun portal that goes to this place where the time is going faster. Doesn't mean it's outside of our universe. It just means that the local time dilation is faster. There hasn't been the trademark green portal this season, and people are going mad about what the fuck, if anything, does that mean?
It just means they haven't done an episode that required interdimensional travel yet, right?
Yep. But that's the question I have is like, are Dan and Justin like watching the people talk about this show and laughing their asses off because they just like, oh shit, yeah, we just didn't portal gun for three episodes and people are going wild.
Yeah.
Or did they know that people would go wild on this minutia and are like not doing a portal gun just to fuck with people? Or the other plausible thing is, no, it actually means something that they haven't portaled for three episodes.
Sure.
And we're going to find out later what happens. But yeah, I don't trust anything that the decoy Rick said about rules, especially since they, again, were wrong, because the core Uber number one thing they can't do is make more decoys.
Right.
So like, this is Asimov robotics rule. Like if you got a robot that's broken rules 2 and 3, then you're going to be like, but I swear to God, they didn't break rule 1. You know, like, I don't know. Yet. I don't know if I can trust those rules.
Yeah.
Sai concludes with, also, you guys mentioned that the first episode reminds you a lot of Netflix's Dark, and the menacing killing of the second episode reminded you of the series Invincible. Do you guys ever have plans on doing a podcast on either of those shows? Oh, boy, do I have a treat for you. We actually did a whole bunch of shows on Netflix's Dark. Search for Dark and Bald Move. And we are coming up on doing, someone commissioned a podcast on Invincible. Mm-hmm. Which will be probably coming out sometime in August, if I were to guess, based on our recording schedule. But within a couple weeks of like a mid to late August date anyway. So, yeah, they're good news. You can enjoy our Dark. I actually had our buddy Kim Renfro from The Insider, who's one of the foremost Dark experts, come to talk about season 2 and season 3 with us, too. So we've got quite a bit of coverage of Dark, and we'll have at least one episode on Invincible, which I think will be pretty good. So check that out. Thanks for being fans, Sai. And if you would like to send us email, you can do so. It's real easy. RickandMorty@baldmove.com. Send it in and get a chance to have it read next week. That will do it for this week. We got next week Independent Spray, which, damn, guys. Yeah. It's so topical to talk about the environment in a week where Seattle is experiencing 118 degree heat and much of the country is on fire. Mm-hmm. They set the ocean on fire last week. I don't know if you noticed that.
I saw that.
There
yeah.
ripped a portal to hell right up in the Gulf of Mexico. It's pretty fucking incredible. Like, really timely episode, but yet we had Independence Day just last weekend, and we got this Rick Dependent spray next week. What the fuck, guys? What the fuck did you...
It's asking a lot for me to believe that they could, you know, plant the seeds of not doing three portal episodes in a row and mastermind, you know, a whole thing around decoys and outer space and all that, and then fuck up on the weeks for releasing their Independence Day episode.
Yeah, what the hell? You're just gonna like read the calendar upside down or something? I don't know. But that's what we got. A star-spangled episode of Rick and Morty. Maybe? We'll see what this Rick Dependent spray is all about next week. Until then, I'm your host, Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
See you then.
Pickle Me This is distributed and produced by Bald Move. All music featured on this podcast is from the Rick and Morty soundtrack, available from Sub Pop Records. Please subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. To discover the many other great shows we do, please check out baldmove.com.
If you appreciate what we do and want to directly support us, consider joining our club at patreon.com/baldmove
to get access to exclusive bonus audio and video features. Finally, you can follow us on your favorite social media at baldmove. See you next time.